through personal appearances, through a whole lot. And they make a very complicated decision that, frankly, campaign consultants and professionals have never been able to really take apart, understand, predict, or control. And it's that seriousness which with they take this decision that I think saves the system from the kind of manipulation that could ruin it if it didn't exist.
But what are the voters looking for? Do they really care which candidate has the best notion of how to keep the economy on an even keel?
Look, it isn't that easy. I mean, okay. That's why you can't control it. And if I can take a second to this, the politics in this country with the Professor Ginsburg talked about the breakdown of the party system, which is partly a result of technology, partly a result of the fact that the party system used to serve as the ombudsman between the government and the people. The old machines of the major cities and things did that when the immigrant populations came in. But today, congressmen serve that purpose. At the congressional level, you really have 435 ombudsmen elected by constituents who think that they know them and who think that they can solve problems for them. That's why the polls often show at the congressional level, we hate Congress, we disagree with everything our congressman wants or says he wants, but he's pretty good and we're going to reelect him. Congressmen get reelected because they perform that service as the interface between the citizenry and the government. Gubernatorial elections tend to be managerial elections. The instability at the Senate level has resulted, I think, in the past couple of decades from the Senate elections becoming the major ideological elections that we have in this country. Everybody knows that a senator can be dumb as a fence post because he doesn't have to run anything. He isn't responsible for anything. He doesn't know everybody because the state's too big. All he has to do is vote the way they want him to vote. So they vote for people that are dumb as a fence post and can't run anything. At the presidential level, however, it's a lot different. And they don't vote just on issues. They don't vote just on character or just on all of these things. They vote on a whole combination of issues. And I think what they do, and I really believe this, they somehow look at these candidates and they say, is that somebody that I would trust to handle a problem that I can't conceive coming up 2 or 3 years from now? And worse, that candidate can't conceive coming up. And would he handle it in a way that I'd feel comfortable about? Does he have common sense? Does he have the general view of the world that I do? All of those things are important. But I think it is a very, very complicated kind of decision that you can't take apart. And you can't say it's made because of the candidate stands on these seven issues or because of the way the candidate looks or presents himself or any of these things. I think it's a combination, and I think it involves a very complicated individual assessment of the character, stands, and vision of the candidate that nobody has been able to control.
President Ginsburg, what kind of precedents do we get on these ethereal criteria?
Well, as always, I'll exercise my prerogative and not answer that question. Because we've been talking for 45 minutes about presidential elections. We've talked about voters, parties, polls, but we've not talked about the central institution of the contemporary American political process. It's that nasty five-letter word. Close your ears. M-E-D-I-A, the media. You know, when Ronald Reagan talked about the evil empire, he meant CBS. He didn't mean SEBI. One element of our presidential selection process that's absolutely critical, obviously, is the role of media. To a significant extent, media, television in particular, but newspapers, obviously, to a very substantial extent, have taken the place of party organizations in terms of performing the function of vetting candidates. Nowadays, in fact, I remember a David Broder column in which Broder explained that now it was the duty of the media to serve a kind of quality control function.
It was sort of a transitional period in the
Well, this was the explanation for why it was okay to dump poor Gary Hart. But nowadays, the media tell us a good deal of what we know about candidates. When voters look candidates right in the eye and try to make their decisions, and what much of what they know about the candidate is what they learn in the media. And sometimes I'm troubled by this.
Well, one of the things that's happened is that the electronic media has served to play a homogenizing role. I mean, the same information goes out to everybody. It's no longer a matter of what local party leaders are saying or what the local newspaper is reporting. It's a matter of what these half-hour broadcasts are doing and saying and putting on the air. Now, I think if we're talking about them as transmitters of information, they probably don't do a very good job. But given their structure, I'm not sure they could. On the other hand, if you were to go out and ask a sample of the American public some information questions about the candidates who are running for president now, they probably would do a lot better than if that same series of questions were asked to the candidates running in 1896.
Well, in 1896, they didn't need to know so much about candidates. They had parties to help them make
decisions. To guide them. To tell them what to do.
But I agree with you completely that in terms of providing information, the media are wonderful. But sometimes don't the media go beyond information to offer interpretations of candidates' characters, personalities, and fitness for office that are labeled news rather than interpretations?
The fact is that have party machines and party organizations been dismantled? Yes. Why? Because we wanted to do that. For all the wonderful things you want to say about Mayor Daley, he's corrupt. And in 1968, the Democratic Party went through, convinced the Democratic Party, we don't want to turn this party over to party bosses. Now, for better or worse, they moved into one extreme. Maybe this year, with the whole purpose of these superdelegates is designed to put a little politics back into politics. We'll see whether that works. But have party machines gone by the boards? Yes, we as Americans wanted that to occur because of Vietnam and a whole lot of other things. Have the media replaced the parties? To be sure. But I think that there are some real benefits to that, one of which is, like it or not, the way an American president leads the country is through television. And if that candidate has got a competency in television, that will help that person lead this country, mobilize public opinion, and shove the country in a direction. It's nothing to do with position papers or balanced budgets. And I think it's no irony in my mind that one of the most popular presidents of this century is Ronald Reagan, an actor who had, despite all the shortcomings you want to say about Reagan, he's a master at that art of communicating. I don't think that that's bad. I think that it's good that a president can lead the country.
On that note, we'll pause for questions from the floor. 1896 was mentioned. Who was it that said, "Thou shalt not press down upon the brow of labor a crown of thorns, thou shalt not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold"? Jesse Jackson said it, yes, just last week.
Well, on that point, I know that the question that actually involves Jesse Jackson and kind of encompasses the discussion. And what exactly do you think the role of the media is in shaping this political process? I mean, we've obviously experienced the overwhelming power of the media, and Jesse Jackson's a case in point. Throughout the whole first leg of the election, you've seen how he's been basically ignored, downplayed, not given the attention that he has deserved or not deserved. And now he's basically the golden child of the media. They've been giving an incredible amount of attention. And does his new popularity parallel this attention? And what basically, what role is the power of the media? How powerful is the media? Is really what I want to ask.
Well, I think there's a question within the question. Is the word or the line overpowering power of the media a cliche? Does it bear weight? If the power was overpowering, how did Jesse Jackson make it if he was opposed by the media?
The answer is media people, including this reporter, and I think every reporter in America, did not believe Jesse Jackson could get elected, did not have a shot, and therefore he was not scrutinized. Pete DuPont was not scrutinized. Bruce Babbitt was not scrutinized. Why? Because no one ever thought they had a chance. You start getting a campaign that starts moving up, and starts looking like it has a chance, and the scrutiny increases.
Yeah.
Even USA Today is a good source on this, because I think every Monday they put a summary of the number of minutes a candidate has gotten on national television news broadcasts and an assessment of whether this is positive or negative coverage. And essentially it runs with victories, so that Dick Gephardt after the Iowa caucus got a lot of coverage and it tended to be neutral, maybe moderately positive. If you look at the coverage of Jesse Jackson in the last couple of weeks, it's been enormous. Many more minutes to him than to either of the other Democratic candidates remaining. And it seems to be sort of even, maybe a little negative. Now, I mean, that's useful to look at as sort of a hard count of minutes and of somebody's judgment as to whether this is positive or negative. You may want to disagree with the judgment, but at least it's some such substance to look at. The way television has covered this campaign is very different from the way television has covered any campaign, any presidential campaign up to now. Somebody made the reference, it's zone coverage, it's not man-to-man. Before the 1988 campaign, every candidate running would have a producer, correspondent, and crew assigned to him. They would follow him. They would do pieces on the individual candidate and what the candidate did that day. Some candidates never got on. Fritz Hollings might have gotten one piece. There was one piece about him on the CBS Evening News in 1984. But there was essentially a focus on the candidate and the campaign. This year, we started out with 13 candidates. No news organization can finance that kind of coverage of 13 individuals. So there's been more of a sort of going around looking at some subject and dealing with the candidates in that context. And I think that served to play down focus on individual candidates, at least early on. Instead of this former man-to-man coverage, what happened at both CBS and ABC is that newly hired people, people who'd been working there for a year, 2 years, in relatively low-level jobs, answering telephones, were given, as it was said, a package of quarters and sent out to go with the campaign. So there was somebody there who was a lot cheaper than the other.
David Keene, do you think the power of the press in this election or the most recent past ones, or in general in running this country, is overwhelming or overrated?
I think it's overrated.
Amen. Okay.
I have a question specifically about the Jackson campaign. I wonder, especially reading some reports in this day after the Wisconsin election, there was the sense that he's not electable. And the SAB is wonderful representation of the American people. Said a poll voters who said, I like Mr. Jackson, I would have voted for him, but I heard he wasn't elected. And that seems to me the sort of tyrannical influence of polls, and that it makes people think that their decision has already been made. And I wonder, I'm glad that some people brought up the informational use of polls for candidates, I think that's interesting. But I wonder where, first of all, someone on the panel could tell me what the sensibility is that Jackson held back for.
He has never held public office before. He has made statements that and actions that a large portion of the American electorate, including a fairly sizable segment in this state, think are anti-Semitic. I think those are two very big things that have to do with why he has high negatives. If you look at polls, he has incredibly high negatives. People just don't like him. Well,
let me say something about that issue.
Point of order. We'll go from right.
I don't think you're going to find that when you analyze why people voted for or against Jesse Jackson, that it was because he was electable or not electable, or because he was. I think that people may have said, "I've heard that he isn't electable" or whatever. But the electability issue. In the time that I've been involved in politics, has never elected anybody to anything or gotten anybody the nomination. It's usually the last thing that you say before you close the door. People yeah. vote for candidates because the candidate somehow makes a connection with them, or because they see something in his candidacy or her candidacy that gives them something to gain. They don't elect him because they can be elected.
I'm not a fan either.
But there is something tentative about Jackson's campaign because of.
I mean, the man is, frankly, actually the Jackson campaign does demonstrate something about the media, a lot of times the candidate who is not on top benefits greatly from the fact that his campaign does not get the critical kind of coverage that the front runner gets, because it allows you to open in Hartford, if you will, rather than on Broadway. It allows you to rewrite the third act. It allows you to get it together before you have to face all the lights and all the cameras and all the critical press, so that when you break through and it does hit you, you might be ready for it. The fact is that a lot of candidates over a lot of time have developed to an essentially critical mass, in part because they have not suffered the early critical coverage that might have destroyed their candidacy in its infancy. And I think the Jackson candidacy is a candidacy of that type. Dave mentioned some of the things. This is a man who thinks that Muammar Gaddafi's a Boy Scout. This is a man who stood shoulder to shoulder with Fidel Castro. This is a man who is outside the mainstream of both political parties in this country and was able to shape a campaign on other issues. And with the press and with his critics ignoring those things precisely because they thought he couldn't be elected. Now he's on Broadway and the lights are on and he's facing that critical press. Had he gotten that earlier, he never would have gotten to this point. And I think that a lot of other candidates who start out, get up there, and then fall back have that same advantage in that they're able to put something together before they face the critical press and before they face those lights. And then when they do face them, they can't stand up to it.
Kathy, do not the polling data, exit polls and others, give some clue as to the composition of Jackson's or anybody else's vote, and therefore the chances that their primary votes can be translated into general election votes or not?
Well, there's one state whose electorate really brought the Jackson campaign to the fore, and that was the state of Michigan. There is no exit polling data from the state of Michigan. There was no information for reporters to draw from to talk about that Jackson victory and figure out what it was and what was it that gave Jackson that victory. There's been some subsequent aggregate analysis of it that tells us two things. The turnout rate among black voters in the state of Michigan was 15% for that event. Among white voters, it was 2%. Only 200,000 people voted in the Michigan quasi-primary, party-run primary. And without information, you start drawing conclusions. In the state of Wisconsin, Jesse Jackson took 23% of the white vote, the largest share that he's gotten to date, from what we know. He took that share of the vote, approximately that share of the vote, among every social group of whites. Up until the Wisconsin primary, people were talking about white supporters of Jesse Jackson as the Peugeot proletariat. It was concentrated among people who had graduate degrees, who earned over $35,000 a year, and who were young. Wisconsin was different. I mean, Wisconsin was clearly more of an across-the-board support. It was not what people expected after Michigan, however.
Next question.
Let me finish answering this one. And I think the message that comes through from all these answers is that the media didn't suppress the Jackson candidacy. It was the availability of mass media or the centrality of mass media rather than political party organizations that permitted Jackson candidacy. It was because the national media were available to Jackson that he was able to make himself a serious candidate. And the polls, I think, rather than discourage people from voting for Jackson, if anything, encouraged people to vote for Jackson because there was an a priori assumption among all experts that Jackson was utterly unelectable and couldn't draw white votes. Polls, if anything, suggested that Jackson wasn't quite so unelectable and indeed, under certain circumstances, could draw white votes.
Let me say something about the whole issue of electability. You rarely find it expressed by voters. You rarely find voters saying, I'm voting for this person because I think he can win. You often find just the opposite, with people expressly saying, I'm voting for this person even though I think this other person is going to win the election. If people voted on the basis of people they thought would win, Walter Mondale would have gotten only about a third of the votes that he got in the 1984 election. Two-thirds of his voters were convinced that Ronald Reagan was going to win. They voted for him anyway. Many of the Jackson supporters will tell you that they think Michael Dukakis is the most electable candidate. They're voting for Jesse Jackson anyway.
Jesse Jackson, of course, one of the most dramatic personalities to put on anybody's platform or tube. I don't know if you heard the line yesterday expressed by Richard Nixon that politics at its best is poetry, that Jesse Jackson and Mario Cuomo are poets, and Mike Dukakis is a word processor. which goes to demonstrate that some of the cleverest people in America are our white-collar criminals. Next question.
It's always good. I have a question
about the primary process and the election process. Would it be possible to substitute our system where we have a lot of emphasis on, say, Iowa and New Hampshire, which are atypical states in the union, to more of either a national primary, which I've heard is unworkable because the country is so large, or a series of, say, regional primaries, where we have primaries the size of
David Keene, how would that affect planning a political campaign?
I think a national primary or a series of mega primaries, such as we had on the Super Tuesday, states run on a regional basis, would be a disaster from the standpoint of the system. They'd obviously, any kind of thing, help some candidates. But the closer you get to a national primary, the more you give a lock to the front runner, because of the financial needs, because of the fact that it's very difficult in that kind of a mega system to break through the advantages that the front runner has. In a retail state like Iowa, like New Hampshire, all of the candidates get an opportunity to get down there, to face the voters, and try to sell their wares, if you will. They can't all do it. Even if they do, they may not be able to capitalize on it. They may not be able to go all the way. But I think there's something important in the system that we have up front some states where candidates have that choice, where candidates have that chance, where the people have an opportunity to listen to the candidate, whether they're inside or outside the mainstream, whether they've got money or no money, and give the and the people have a chance to make the decision. Now, Iowa is criticized now for being unrepresentative. It is. New Hampshire used to be criticized for being unrepresentative. It is, and it was. And so is any other state. But there has to be someplace. We were talking earlier, and Dave suggested the idea of maybe two or three or four, I guess it was Babbitt's idea, two or three or four small states. I had half facetiously and half seriously suggested that if we wanted to have a reform, the problem with Iowa is, I don't know how many of you ever seen the old 1940s movie with Jimmy Stewart called Magic Town, about the perfect town where you could take a poll just by asking people on the street because it was perfectly representative, and then everybody found out about it and screwed it up. And in a sense, that's what's happened to Iowa because of the massive influx of media and money and all of the things that happened. And my suggested, as I say, half facetious, reform was to take all the states below a certain population size and put them in a barrel, and then 18 months before each election we should draw one and say this is where it starts. But for God's sakes, give us some place that's manageable for it to start, so that everybody who has a reasonable claim to running for president has an opportunity to go out and test that claim on popular opinion. And you can't do that with a mega primary, and you can't do it with a national primary.
There are two criticisms that are made of, or if I can, of Iowa.
It's too cold.
And they're both right.
Three.
One is it's atypical, and the second is that too much attention is paid to it. And both are correct. As David mentioned, no state is typical. And secondly, wherever you start the selection of an American president, particularly in a year like 1988, wide open, nobody knows who it's going to be. You're going to have a hell of a lot of reporters there. It's a big story. There are a lot of different options for changing and reforming, quote-unquote, the process, and every year it gets reformed.
The real problem is the second or third time around they raised the hotel rates so high.
But one idea that has been advanced was Bruce Babbitt's idea, which I think is one we may hear more about, and that is you have Iowa and New Hampshire go on the same day and add two other states in different regions of the country, maybe Utah or the state of Washington, so that you would not have the emphasis placed on one state, you'd have geographic diversity, and you would not have all this attention being paid to one place. I don't know whether it's right or wrong. There are other suggestions, like you have time zone primaries, where in each time zone holds primaries, lotteries. I think personally we're moving toward regional primaries.
I think it's a mistake.
Well, you can see the beginnings of a Midwest regional primary. You can see some hints of it in New England. So I'm not sure, I'm not saying one is better than the other or you should or not. That's not my role as a reporter. But in answering your question, I think it's clear that changes are in the works, and the party that loses the election will be the party where that change is most likely to come. The party that wins the election is going to think it's not a bad process.
I just want to draw a parallel between this question and the last one about the power of the media, because the implication of what has been said here is not that Iowa and New Hampshire represent a colossal opportunity to manipulate or be manipulated by the news media, but that the states like that represent an opportunity for a candidate to go out and actually meet voters, and for voters to take a proprietary interest in the candidate one-to-one. And if that's the case, maybe it ain't all bad. Kathy?
The one comment I'd like to make about the process as it is now is that it's a tremendously grueling process for both candidates and those people who cover them. Up through the Illinois primary, which was March 15th, which was barely 5 weeks after the Iowa caucuses, you had Iowa, New Hampshire, South Dakota, Minnesota, and the Southern Regional primary on Super Tuesday. You had nearly half, I think half the delegates selected in that period. You had people making decisions on the fly, both media making decisions on the fly and candidates making decisions on the fly. And you had organizations running on adrenaline. I'm not sure if people make good decisions under those conditions.
I think it's terrible that we have a system that's hard on the media. We should have one which could be watched on television. Yeah, I think that I agree with everything that's been said. I simply want to point out one more thing, and that is that when you talk about reforming the system, and probably the members of the panel with the help of the members of the audience could develop the ideal presidential selection system. We could certainly develop an interesting and ingenious system, but in the real world, presidential selection systems, any kind of leadership selection systems, don't come from nowhere. They're created by politicians who are seeking to establish rules that work to their advantage and to the disadvantage of the opposition. The present rules we have are a legacy of the McGovern-Fraser Commission of the early 1970s, which sought to write rules that would permit a certain set of forces within the Democratic Party, for the most part middle and upper middle class liberals who opposed the Vietnam War, et cetera, to dominate the presidential selection process. And it was no coincidence that the rules written by the McGovern-Fraser Commission resulted in the selection of George McGovern as the Democratic Party's nominee. Similarly, the various reforms that are proposed today are seldom, except by academics and intellectuals, proposed in a vacuum. Generally, when politicians put forward ideas for reform, however ingenious these ideas are, however well grounded they are philosophically, historically, economically, and socially, generally politicians are seeking to write rules that work to their own advantage. So it's very good. It's prudent to be suspicious of reforms.
Next, please.
Yeah, I'd like to bring up a slightly different issue. In today's world, where foreign policy is absolutely key to our national security, and the president is a key player in our international politics, how much of a role do you think public opinion should have on the debates and issues that are brought up in the presidential debate, when in fact the public may not be as knowledgeable or as interested in foreign policy?
I don't think voters care much about foreign policy unless American boys are getting killed, and then they care a lot about it, and then they tend to rally around the flag. Other than that, it's a pocketbook issue.
I think it goes beyond that, but in the context of what I was talking about before, voters gain a sense of a candidate's ability to deal with these kinds of things. It doesn't always require that he had foreign policy experience, if you will, before, or that he has it now, but they do get a sense of the differences between candidates and a sense of how the candidates would deal with these things. They care about specific issues, or different groups within our society care about specific foreign policy issues, and they have a sense of America's place in the world and the role that America ought to play. There's differences within the electorate on that. I think Dave is right in terms of the kinds of issues that they focus on unless there's some kind of a crisis, but I would not underplay the sort of overriding importance of the foreign policy issues.